First of all, in enduring hardship, he wasn't just better than me. He was better than everyone whenever we were cut off somewhere and forced to go without food. As happens on campaign, the rest of us were nothing compared to him for holding out. And then again at feasts, he was the only one able to enjoy himself properly, and though he didn't care to drink whenever he was forced to, he outdrank everyone, and most amazing of all, no one has ever seen Socrates drunk. I think you'll get proof of that soon enough. And when it came to enduring the winter, the winters there are fierce, he did astonishing things. And once, when there was a frost as bad as could be, and everyone either stayed inside, or if they went out, wrapped themselves up in unbelievable amounts of clothing and shoes, wound their feet in felt and sheepskins, he went out among them, wearing the same kind of cloak he always used to wear before, and walked over the ice barefoot more easily than the others did in their shoes. The soldiers looked at him sideways, thinking he was showing contempt for them. So much for that. But here's another thing this tough man did, and endured there once on campaign, worth hearing. He'd been thinking about something from early morning, standing there working it out, and since it wasn't coming to him, he wouldn't give up, but kept standing there searching. It was already noon, and people noticed, and in amazement told one another that Socrates had been standing there thinking about something since dawn. Finally, toward evening, some of the Ionians, after they'd had dinner, it was summer then, brought out their bedding and slept in the cool air, partly to keep watch and see whether he'd go on standing there through the night too. And he stood there until dawn came and the sun rose. Then he walked off, after saying a prayer to the sun. And if you like, in battles, since it's only fair to give him his due there, when the battle happened, in which the generals gave me the prize for bravery, no one else saved me but him. He refused to leave me behind when I was wounded, and saved both my weapons and me myself. And I told the generals then too, Socrates, to give the prize to you, and you won't blame me for that or say I'm lying. But when the generals, looking to my rank, wanted to give the prize to me, you were more eager than they were that I should get it rather than you. There's something else too, gentlemen, well worth seeing Socrates when the army was retreating in flight from Delium. I happened to be there on horseback, while he was on foot with the heavy infantry. He was retreating along with Laches, the men already scattered, and I came upon them by chance, and as soon as I saw them, I told them both to keep their courage up, and said I wouldn't leave them. There I got an even better look at Socrates than I had at Potidaea, since I was less afraid myself, being on horseback. First of all, how much more collected he was than Laches, and then it seemed to me, Aristophanes, exactly as you put it once, that he walked along there just as he does here, strutting like a proud bird, glancing sideways, calmly keeping an eye on both friend and enemy, making it clear to anyone, even from a great distance, that if someone laid a hand on this man, he'd defend himself with real force. That's why he got away safely, both he and his companion, for as a rule, people in that state of mind aren't even touched in war. It's the ones who flee headlong that they chase down. One could say many other admirable things in praise of Socrates. But while for his other habits, one might perhaps say similar things about someone else, the fact that he's like no one else, not among people of the past, nor among those alive now, that's a thing worth every kind of wonder. You could compare Achilles to Brasidas and others of that sort, or Pericles to Nestor or Antenor, there are others too, and compare the rest by the same standard. But the sheer strangeness of this man here, both himself and his way of talking, you couldn't find anything close to it if you searched, not among people now nor those of the past, unless you compared him, as I do, to no human being at all, but to the Silenus figures and the satyrs, both the man himself and his words. And in fact, I left out something important earlier, that his words too are exactly like those hollow Silenus figures that open up. If you were willing to listen to Socrates talk, his words would seem completely ridiculous at first. He wraps them up in language and phrases like that, the hide of some insolent satyr. He talks about pack donkeys, he says, and blacksmiths and cobblers and tanners, and he always seems to be saying the same things through the same examples, so that anyone inexperienced or thoughtless would laugh at his arguments. But if you open them up and get inside them, you'll find first that they're the only arguments with any sense in them, and second, that they're the most godlike, holding within them the most images of virtue, and reaching toward the widest range of things, really, toward everything a person needs to consider who means to become truly good. That's what I have to praise Socrates for, gentlemen. And as for what I blame him for, I've mixed that in too, and told you how he's mistreated me. And it isn't only me he's done this to, Charmides son of Glaucon, and Euthydemus son of Diocles, and a great many others he deceives them, playing the beloved when really he's the lover, not the other way around. So I'm warning you too, Agathon, don't be taken in by him. Learn from what's happened to us, and be on your guard, and don't wait to learn it the hard way, the way the proverb says the fool does. When Alcibiades said this, there was laughter at his frankness, because he still seemed to be in love with Socrates. And Socrates said, "You seem sober to me, Alcibiades. Otherwise, you'd never have tried so cleverly to wrap everything around and hide the real reason you said all this, tossing it in at the end as if it were an afterthought, as though you hadn't said the whole thing just to set Agathon and me against each other. You think I ought to love you and no one else, and that Agathon ought to be loved by you and no one else. But you weren't as subtle as you thought. That little Saturnine-Silenus drama of yours came through clear as day. Well, my dear Agathon, don't let him get away with it. Make sure no one turns the two of us against each other." And Agathon said, "Really, Socrates, I think you may be right. I take it as a sign that he lay down between the two of us, just to keep us apart. But it won't do him any good. I'll come over and lie down next to you." "By all means," said Socrates, "come lie down here below me."
"Zeus,"
cried Alcibiades, "look what I put up with from this man. He thinks he has to get the better of me every way there is. But if nothing else, you remarkable man, at least let Agathon lie between us." "That's impossible," said Socrates. "You praised me, so now it's my turn to praise the man on my right. If Agathon lies down next to you, he'll have to praise me all over again, instead of being praised by me, which is what he should be. So no, dear friend, don't grudge the boy a little praise from me. I'm quite eager to sing his praises myself."
"Harvey," said Agathon,
"Alcibiades, there's no way I can stay here now. I'll get up and move at once, so that I can be praised by Socrates." "There it is," said Alcibiades, "the usual thing. Whenever Socrates is around, no one else gets a chance with the good-looking ones. See how easily, how persuasively, he's just found a reason to get this one to lie down beside him." So Agathon got up to go lie down next to Socrates. But just then, a great crowd of revelers arrived at the door, and finding it open because someone was just leaving, they came straight in and took their places among the company, and everything filled up with noise, and there was no more order to anything. People were forced to drink enormous quantities of wine. At that point, Aristodemus said, Eryximachus and Phaedrus and some of the others got up and left, while he himself fell asleep and slept a long while, since the nights were long at that season. He woke up close to dawn, when the roosters were already crowing. And when he woke, he saw that the others were either asleep or had gone, and that only Agathon, Aristophanes, and Socrates were still awake, drinking from a large bowl that was being passed around to the right. Socrates was talking with them, and Aristodemus said he didn't remember most of what was said, since he hadn't been there from the beginning and kept dozing off. But the main point, he said, was that Socrates was forcing them to agree that the same man ought to know how to write both comedy and tragedy, and that the skilled tragic poet was, by the same skill, a comic poet too. pressed into this argument, and not following it very closely, they were nodding off. Aristophanes fell asleep first, and then, as day was already breaking, Agathon too. Socrates, having gotten them both settled to sleep, got up and left, and Aristodemus, as usual, went with him. He went to the Lyceum, washed himself, and spent the rest of the day there just as he would any other day, and after spending it so, rested at home that evening.